You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the review of the book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles by Bruce Lipton, PhD. And last show, we were looking at the introduction. My exploration of the secrets of life led me into a research career studying the character of cloned human cells grown into culture. 10 years after my first close encounter with an electron microscope, I was a tenured faculty member at the prestigious University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, internationally recognized for my research on cloned stem cells and honored for my teaching skills. I had graduated to more powerful electron microscopes that allowed me to make three-dimensional CAT scan-like rides through organisms when I came face-to-face with the molecules that are the very foundation of life itself. Though my tools were more sophisticated, my approach hadn't changed. I'd never lost my 7-year-old conviction that the lives of cells I studied for that purpose. Unfortunately, I had no such conviction that my own life had a purpose. I didn't believe in God, though I confess that on occasion I entertained the notion of a God who ruled with an extremely honed, perverse sense of humor. I was, after all, a traditional biologist for whom God's existence is an unnecessary question. Life is the consequence of blind chance, the flip of a friendly card, or to be more precise, the random shake of a genetic dice. The motto of our profession since the time of Charles Darwin has been God. We don't need no stinking God. It's not that Darwin denied the existence of God. He simply implied that chance, not divine intervention, was responsible for the character of life on Earth. In his 1859 book, The Origin of the Species, Darwin said that the individual traits are passed from parents to their children. He suggested that hereditary factors passed from parent to child control the characteristics of an individual's life. That bit of insight set scientists off on a frenzied attempt to dissect life down to its molecular nuts and bolts. For within the structure of the cell was to be found the hereditary mechanism that controlled life. The search came to a remarkable end 50 years ago when James Watson and Francis Crick described the structure and function of the DNA double helix, the material of which genes are made. Scientists finally figured out the nature of the hereditary factors that Darwin had written into the 19th century. The tabloids heralded the brave new world of genetic engineering with its promise of designer babies and magic bullet medical treatments. I vividly remember the large block print headlines that filled the front page on that memorable day in 1953. Secret of life discovered. Like the tabloids, biologists jumped on the gene bandwagon. The mechanism by which DNA controls biological life became the central dogma of molecular biology. painstakingly spelled out in textbooks. In the long-running debate of nature over nurture, the pendulum swung decidedly to nature. At first, DNA was thought to be responsible only for our physical characteristics. But then we started believing that our genes control our emotions and behaviors as well. So if you are born with a defective happiness gene, you can expect to have an unhappy life. Unfortunately, I thought I was one of those people victimized by a missing or mutant happiness gene. I was reeling from a relentless barrage of debilitating emotional roundhouse punches. My father had just died after a long, pain-fraught battle with cancer. I was his principal caretaker and had spent the previous 4 months flying back and forth between my job in Wisconsin and his home in New York every 3 or 4 days. In between stays at his deathbed, I was trying to maintain a research program, teach, and write a major grant renewal for the National Institutes of Health. To further compound my stress levels, I was in the midst of an emotionally draining and economically devastating divorce. My financial resources were rapidly depleted as I tried to feed and clothe my new dependents, the judicial system, economically challenged and homeless. I found myself living pretty much out of a suitcase in the most abysmal garden apartment complex. Most of my neighbors were hoping to upgrade their living standards by seeking accommodations in trailer parks. I was particularly scared of my next-door neighbors. My apartment was broken into, and my new stereo system was stolen in the first week of residence. A week later, 6-foot-tall, 3-foot-wide Buddha knocked at my door, holding a quart of beer in one hand and picking his teeth with a 10-penny nail held in the other. Buddha wanted to know if I had directions for the tape deck. The nadir was the day I threw the phone through the glass door of my office, shattered the Bruce H. Lipton, Ph.D. Associate Professor of Anatomy, UW School of Medicine sign, all the while screaming, "Get me out of here!" My meltdown was precipitated by a phone call from a banker who politely but firmly told me he couldn't approve my mortgage application. It was like the scene from Terms of Endearment when Deirdre Wingler aptly responds to her husband's hopes for tenure. "We don't have enough money to pay the bills now. All tenure means is we won't have enough money forever." The magic of cells. Déjà vu. Luckily, I found an escape in the form of a short-term sabbatical at a medical school in the Caribbean. I knew all my problems would not disappear there, but as the jet broke through the gray cloud above Chicago, I felt that way. I bit the inside of my cheek to prevent the smile on my face from evolving into audible laughter. I felt as joyful as my 7-year-old self first discovering my life's passion, the magic of cells. My mood lifted even more on the 6-passenger commuter plane I took from Montserrat, a mere 4-by-12-mile dot in the Caribbean Sea. If there ever was a Garden of Eden, it probably would have resembled my new island home, erupting out of the sparkling aquamarine sea like a giant multifaceted emerald. When we landed, the gardenia laced balmy breezes that swept the airport's tarmac were intoxicating. The native custom was to dedicate the sunset period as a time of quiet contemplation, a custom I readily adopted. As each day wound down, I looked down to the heavenly light show. My house, situated on a cliff 50 feet above the ocean, faced due west. A winding path through the tree-covered fern grotto led me down to the water. At the bottom of the grotto, an opening through the wall of jasmine bushes revealed a secluded beach where I enhanced the sunset ritual by washing away the day with a few laps in the warm, gin-clear water. After my swim, I would mold the beach sand into a comfortable recliner, sit back, and watch the sun set slowly into the sea. On that remote island, I was out of the rat race and free to see the world without the blinders of civilization's dogmatic beliefs. At first, my mind was constantly reviewing and critiquing the debate that was my wife, my life, that had soon appeared to have turned into a debacle. But soon, my mental, Siskel, and Ebert ceased their thumbs up, down review of my 40 years. I began to re-experience what it was like to live in the moment and for the moment, to become reacquainted with sensations last experienced as a carefree child, to again feel the pleasure of being alive. I became more human and more humane while living in that island paradise. I also became a better cell biologist. Almost all of my formal scientific training was in sterile, lifeless classrooms, lecture halls, and laboratories. However, once I was immersed in the Caribbean's rich ecosystem, I began to appreciate biology as a living, breathing, integrated system rather than a collection of individual species sharing a piece of the Earth's turf. Sitting quietly within garden-like island jungles and snorkeling among the jeweled coral reefs gave me a window into the island's amazing integration of plant and animal species. All live in a delicate, dynamic balance, not only with other life forms, but with other physical, their physical environment as well. It was life's harmony, not life's struggle, that sang out to me as I sat in the Caribbean Garden of Eden. I became convinced that contemporary biology pays too little attention to the important role of the cooperation because its Darwinian roots emphasize life's competitive nature. To the chagrin of my U.S. faculty colleagues, I returned to Wisconsin, a screaming radical bent on challenging the sacred foundational beliefs of biology. I even began to openly criticize Charles Darwin and the wisdom of this theory of evolution. In the eyes of most other biologists, my behavior was tantamount to a priest bursting into the Vatican and claiming that the Pope was a fraud. My colleagues could be forgiven for thinking a coconut had hit me on the head when I quit my tenured position and fulfilling my life's dream to be a rock and roll band, took off on a music tour. I discovered Yanni, who eventually became a big celebrity, and produced a laser show with him. But it soon became clear that I had a lot more aptitude for teaching and research than I had for producing rock and roll shows. I wound down my midlife crisis, which I'll describe in more agonizing detail in later chapters, by giving up the music business and returning to the Caribbean to teach cell biology once again. My final stop in conventional academia was at Stanford University School of Medicine. By that time, I was an unabashed proponent of new biology. I had come to question not only Darwin's dog-eat-dog version of evolution, but also biology's central dogma, the premise that genes control life. That scientific premise has one major flaw. Genes cannot turn themselves on or off. In more scientific terms, genes are not self-emergent. Something in the environment has to trigger gene activity. Though that fact had already been established by frontier science, conventional scientists blinded by genetic dogma had simply ignored it. My outspoken challenge of the central dogma turned me into an even more of a scientific heretic. Not only was I a candidate for excommunication, I was now suitable for burning at the stake. In a lecture during my interview at Stanford, I found myself accusing the gathered faculty, many of them international recognized geneticists, of being no better than religious fundamentalists for adhering to the central dogma, despite evidence to the contrary. After my scandalous comments, the lecture room erupted into shouts of outrage that I thought meant the end of my job application. Instead, my insights concerning the mechanics of the new biology proved to be provocative enough to actually get me hired. With the support of some eminent scientists at Stanford, especially from the pathology department chairman, Dr. Klaus Binsch, I was encouraged to pursue my ideas and apply them to research on cloned human cells. To the surprise of those around me, the experiments fully supported the alternate view of biology that I was postulating. I published 2 papers based on this research and left academia, this time for good. I left because, despite the support I got at Stanford, I felt that my message was falling on deaf ears. Since my departure, my research was consistently validating my skepticism about the central dogma of the primacy of DNA in controlling life. In fact, epigenetics, the study of the molecular mechanisms by which environment controls gene activity, is today one of the most active areas of scientific research. The newly emphasized role of the environment in regulating gene activity was the focus of my cell research 25 years ago, long before the field of epigenetics was even established. While that is gratifying for me intellectually, I know that if I were teaching and researching in a medical school, my colleagues would still be wondering about those coconuts, because in the last decade, I've become even more of a radical by academia's standards. My preoccupation with the new biology has become even more of an intellectual exercise. I believe that cells teach us not only about the mechanisms of life, but also teach us how to live rich, full lives. In ivory tower science, that kind of thinking would no doubt win me the wacky Dr. Doolittle Award for anthropomorphism, or precisely cytopomorphism, thinking like a cell. But for me, it's biology 101. You may consider yourself an individual, but as a cell biologist, I can tell you that you are in truth a cooperative community of approximately 50 trillion single-celled citizens. Almost all of the cells that make up your body are amoeba-like, individual organisms that have evolved a cooperative strategy for their mutual survival. Reduced to basic terms, human beings are simply the consequence of collective amoebic consciousness. As a nation reflects in the traits of its citizens, our humanness must reflect the basic nature of our cellular communities. Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles by Bruce H. Lipton, PhD. We're looking now at the section, Living the Lessons of Cells. Using cell communities as role models, I came to the conclusion that we are not victims of our genes, but masters of our fates, able to create lives overflowing with peace, happiness, and love. I tested my hypothesis in my own life after a nudge from my audiences who asked me why my insights hadn't made me any happier. They were right. I needed to integrate my new biological awareness into my daily life. I knew I had succeeded when, on a bright Sunday morning in the Big Easy, a coffee shop waitress asked me, "Honey, you are the happiest person I ever did see. Tell me, child, why are you so happy?" I was taken aback by her question, but nevertheless I blurted out, "I'm in heaven." The waitress shook her head from side to side, mumbling, "My, my," and then proceeded to take my breakfast order. Well, it was true. I was happy. Happier than I'd ever been at any other time in my life.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC. But it's one you can help prevent. spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenari, professional futurist.
A number of you critical readers may rightly be skeptical of my claim that Earth is heaven. For by definition, heaven is also the abode of the deity and the blessed dead. Did I really think that New Orleans or any other major city could be a part of heaven? Ragged, homeless, women and children living in alleys, air so thick that one would never know if stars really existed, rivers and lakes so polluted that the only unimaginable scary life form could exist in them. This heaven, this earth is heaven. The deity lives here. He knows the deity. The answers to these questions are yes. Yes, and I believe they do. Well, to be completely honest, I must admit that I don't know all of the deity personally, for I don't know all of you. For God's sake, there are over 6 billion of you. And to be more fully honest, I don't really know all of the members of the planet and animal kingdom either, although I believe they also comprise God. In the immortal words of Tool Time's Tim Taylor, "Back the truck up." Is he saying that humans are God? Well, yes, I am. Of course, I'm not the first to have said that. It is written in Genesis that we are made in the image of God. Yes, this card-carrying rationalist is now quoting Jesus, Buddha, and Rumi. I have now come full circle from a reductionist scientific take on life to a spiritual one. We are made in the image of God, and we need to put spirit back into the equation when we want to improve our physical and mental health. Because we are not powerless biochemical machines popping a pill every time we are medically and physically out of tune is not the answer. Drugs and surgery are powerful tools when they are not overused, but the notion of simple drug fixes is fundamentally flawed. Every time a drug is introduced into the body to correct function A, inevitably throws off function B, C, or D, or more worse. It is not gene-directed hormones or neurotransmitters that control our bodies or our minds. Our beliefs control our bodies, our minds, and thus our lives. O ye of little belief! The light outside the box. In this book, I will draw the proverbial line in the sand. On one side of the line is a world defined by neo-Darwinism, which casts life as an unending war among battling biochemical robots. On the other side of the line is the new biology, which casts life as a cooperative journey among powerful individuals who can program themselves to create joy-filled lives. When we cross that line and truly understand the new biology, we will no longer fractiously debate the role of nurture and nature because we will realize that the fully conscious mind trumps both nature and nurture. And I believe we will also experience a profound and pragmatic change into humanity as to when a round world reality was introduced to a flat world civilization. Humanities majors who may be worried that this book offers an incomprehensible science lecture have no fear. When I was an academic, I chafed at the three-piece itchy suit, the constricting tie, the wingtip shoes, and the interminable meetings, but I loved to teach. And in my post-academia life, I've gotten plenty of teaching practice. I've presented the principles of the new biology to thousands of people around the world. Through these lectures, I have honed my presentation of the science into easy-to-understand English illustrated by colorful charts, many of which are replicated in this book. In Chapter 1, I will discuss smart cells and why and how they can teach so much about their own minds and bodies. In Chapter 2, I lay out the scientific evidence to show you that genes do not control biology. I also introduce you to the exciting discoveries of epigenetics, a new field of biology that is unraveling the mysteries of how environment, nature, influences the behavior of cells without changing the genetic code. It is a field which is uncovering new complexities in the nature of disease, including cancer and schizophrenia. Chapter 3 is about the cell membrane, the skin of the cell. You've no doubt heard more about DNA containing nucleus of the cell than you have about its membrane, but frontier science is really revealing in ever greater detail what I've concluded over 20 years, that the membrane is the true brain of the cellular operation. In Chapter 4, I talk about the mind-bending discoveries of quantum physics. These discoveries will have profound implications for understanding and treating disease. However, the conventional medical establishment has not yet incorporated quantum physics into its research or medical school training, with tragic results. In Chapter 5, I'll explain why I named the book The Biology of Belief. Positive thoughts have a profound effect on behavior and genes, but only when they are in harmony with the subconscious programming. And negative thoughts have an equally powerful effect. When we recognize how these positive and negative beliefs control our biology, we can use this knowledge to create lives filled with health and happiness. Chapter 6 reveals why cells and people need to grow and how fear shuts down that growth. Chapter 7 focuses on conscious parenting. As parents, we need to understand the role we play in programming our children's beliefs and the impact these beliefs have on our children's lives. This chapter is important whether you are a parent or not, nor as a former child. The insight into our programming and impact upon our lives is quite revealing. In the epilogue, I reveal how my understanding of the new biology led me to realize the importance of integrating the realms of spirit and science, which was a radical shift from my background as an agnostic scientist. Are you ready to use your conscious mind to create a life overflowing with health, happiness, and love without the aid of genetic engineers and without addicting yourself to drugs? Are you ready to consider an alternate reality to that provided by the medical model of the human body as a biochemical machine? There is nothing to buy and there are no policies to take out. It is just a matter of temporarily suspending the archaic beliefs that you've acquired from the scientific and media establishments so that you can consider the exciting new awareness offered by leading-edge science. So we're going to be examining this book for the next couple of shows. And I think you get some very interesting insights into the research done by this enlightened scientist. So please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.